Super Bowl Sunday has become a sort of secular holiday in the United States, with more than 110 million people watching the game on TV. As with any audience that large, there's bound to be a lot of variance among the viewers. You've got hardcore fans, especially of the teams involved. This year it's the New England Patriots and the Atlanta Falcons. You've got the people who like football well enough but aren't fanatics. And then there's a large swath of people who probably don't watch much football at all. They're primarily there for the party and the chicken wings, or maybe they're new to this country, or at least new to the sport, and they have no clue as to how American football even works. So we thought, what can we here at Freakonomics Radio do to make this secular holiday a little more enjoyable for everyone? And that's why we've assembled a few very bright people, including two current NFL players, a former player who's a two-time Super Bowl champion, and, because this is Freakonomics Radio, a PhD economist, to create this episode, An Egghead's Guide to the Super Bowl.
From WNYC Studios, this is Freakonomics Radio, the show that explores the hidden side of everything. Here's your host, Stephen Dubner.
For our Egghead's Guide to the Super Bowl, we'll start with our resident egghead, Steve Levitt.
Hey, Dubner.
Levitt is my Freakonomics friend and co-author. He's an economist at the University of Chicago. So, Levitt, I've known you a long time, and I know you've written a lot of papers on different sports and elements of sports, sumo wrestling and soccer and sports gambling, for instance. But honestly, if someone were to ask me, hey, is Steve Levitt a sports fan? I don't really know. I don't think you actually enjoy watching just to watch, or you don't really enjoy rooting for a team or anything plebeian like that, do you?
Well, the sad part is I used to. I grew up as a huge sports fan, and then before I wrote papers on sports gambling, I did a lot of sports gambling myself. And although sports gambling was really, really fun, the problem with it was that once you start betting on sports, it became, at least for me, I think for most people, hard to maintain any kind of loyalty to the home teams like the Minnesota Vikings or the Twins that I grew up loving so much. And even though I no longer gamble on sports, I've never been able to get back my mojo when it comes to really caring about a team just for the sake of caring about a team.
So considering that you don't love watching the game just for the sake of the game or the competition or your team, whatever, are there ways that you enjoy it anyway? Are there things that you look for, whether they're kind of brain puzzles or kind of bets against yourself to see, you know, if X happens, will Y happen, and so on?
Well, I don't do anything as intellectual as all that, but I do watch the Super Bowl. And there are at least two things about the Super Bowl which, at least for me, give me a source of entertainment when I watch the games. Now, the first of these, of course, is the ads. And there's really nothing else in the world like Super Bowl ads. And I don't know why I love the ads so much. It's partly because I know so much effort has gone into them, partly because there's so much creativity, and partly because I always do focus on the intellectual side of wondering whether the ads will actually work. And it's an interesting problem. So in general, it's very hard to figure out whether advertising works. In particular, it's extremely difficult to know whether something like a Super Bowl ad actually works. And in a time where now this year, I think the 30-second Super Bowl spot will be selling for $5.5 million, it's a good question to ask whether or not indeed the investment that the firms are making in these ads pay off. And so as I watch the ads, I'm always intrigued to think about whether or not there's any conceivable way that the ad that you're seeing might lead to a positive ROI for the advertisers.
So that's one thing to think about during the Super Bowl, especially if you're not that interested in the football. But what about the football? Let's introduce the rest of our Egghead panel, all of whom are quite qualified on that front.
My name is John Urschel. I'm a PhD student at MIT in applied mathematics, and I also play football for the Ravens in the NFL. Eric Winston. I am a right tackle for the Cincinnati Bengals. Just finished my 11th year, and I am the president of the NFLPA.
Justin Tuck, former NFL defensive end, now Wharton MBA student.
So we've got in John Urschel, a guy getting his math PhD at MIT while playing in the NFL, in Eric Winston, the president of the NFL Players Union, and in Justin Tuck, a recent retiree with two Super Bowl rings, who's now getting his MBA at Wharton. Now, surely their recommendation for what to watch for isn't the same as Steve Levitt's. And yet, it is.
It does not matter how much or how little football you know. You will enjoy the commercials, I can assure you. When they go to commercial break, this is not your time to get up and go to the bathroom and, like, go get some, like, chips and dip.
Watch the halftime show. It's great. The halftime show is phenomenal. The commercials are great, too. The commercials are really funny.
I'll tell them to pay attention to the commercials. The commercials are really good.
Okay, so watch the commercials. As for the game itself, we'll start with what to watch for if you know absolutely nothing about the sport of American football.
I'd say it's very much similar to rugby.
John Urschel, the mathematician.
Except some main differences are when you have the ball and you get tackled, they actually stop play. So rugby, you know, it's continuous play. They actually stop play, and it's a lot of set pieces, which a lot of people who don't watch football and a lot of international people, they think it's kind of strange. They think it's kind of slow. But I think the thing to watch for and appreciate is the fact that because football is broken up into these bits of like 7-8 second plays with these breaks in between, in those 7 and 8 seconds, you get to see so much athleticism and just so much physical talent that it makes it a much higher quality 7 or 8 seconds broken up than if you watch an entire rugby game throughout or an entire soccer game throughout. I can tell you that on every single play, if you watch it closely and you really pay attention to the players, you will see amazing feats of athleticism every single play, which I can't say for every single minute of, say, West Ham versus Arsenal.
I would say if you don't know anything about the game, right, you want to probably watch the person with the ball.
That's Justin Tuck, who played 9 seasons with the New York Giants and 2 with the Oakland Raiders.
Like, obviously, the center has the ball first. He's going to snap it to the quarterback in some capacity, whether he's in shotgun or under center. And then from there, if it's a run play, the quarterback's going to hand the ball to the running back. If it's a pass play, the quarterback's going to drop back and figure out what is the best option for him to disperse the ball to another player.
If you actually want to watch the game, step one, don't bother a guy that's really watching the game to explain it to you.
That's Eric Winston.
Like, that is the worst. Like, we can do that at halftime. We can just right in the middle of the series. Don't start pulling, hey, what's that mean or whatever. So that's step one if you're a novice or you don't really care about the game.
So if you're a football novice and you're watching the Super Bowl, now you've got a few things in your pocket. Watch the ads, of course. During the game, watch the ball, but also take advantage of the stop-and-start nature of the game, that 7 or 8 seconds of amazing athleticism. All right, then. What if you already know a fair amount about the game? We asked our eggheads what you should watch for. John Urschel first.
I think one thing that's always interesting to think about that I think the regular fan who watches a lot of football doesn't kind of put in their head is think about the kind of chess match going on here. Think about the actual strategies that the team have and try to think about what wins and loses a football game. Because you're a football fan, you watch all these games, you root for your team, you're a diehard fan. But really, what are the fundamental things that win and lose football games, and what are the critical moments, and how do you know them when they get there? The sort of awareness of, well, how do these wins and losses really, really come about?
To that end, Justin Tuck suggests you look for patterns in how a given team handles different situations as the game goes on.
You can figure out, depending on what a team had done earlier in the game, why they would come back to do something, later in the game that way. I would say look at personnel, like whether, you know, normally in 3rd and 10, you know, you're going to be more of a pass and attack type of offense. And obviously on defense, they're going to be more in the nickel packages and trying to stop the pass.
Eric Winston has some simple but useful advice for a fairly knowledgeable football fan.
Look who affects the middle of the pocket.
Meaning?
Meaning that see what team can make the quarterback move horizontally.
The quarterbacks to watch this year are Matt Ryan, a great player for most of his 8 seasons with the Falcons, but playing in his first Super Bowl, and Tom Brady of the Patriots, playing in his record 7th Super Bowl.
Tom does a phenomenal job of what they call stepping up in the pocket, meaning that once the ball has been snapped and the quarterback's looking downfield, he moves upward in the pocket, usually right to the direction of where the ball was snapped by the center. He steps up and he's looking to make a good throw because it's easier to make a throw when your shoulders are perpendicular to the line of scrimmage and you can follow through. So if you're affecting that ability, especially for Tom, and making him move sideways, he doesn't throw the ball as well. So Matt's a little bit is similar to Tom Brady in that sense. He likes to play from the pocket. He likes to be able to step up and make throws. He's used to making throws with some guys on him. He's a big guy. If they're pressuring the middle of the pocket and making Matt Ryan move around and move laterally, they'll be better for it.
If this actual football stuff doesn't move you, Eric Winston has something else to think about. Something that comes from playing in the NFL for 11 years and not making it to the Super Bowl.
So this is a little factoid that I'm sure a lot of your audience and might be interested in. Most players, even though they have the option of buying 2 tickets and going to the game, won't go. The active players won't go. The old adage is, you don't go to the Super Bowl until you play in it. They'll come to Houston to go to some of the parties and do some media engagements and talk to people and meet people. But they leave either Sunday morning to get home so they can watch the Super Bowl, or they leave Saturday.
Just because it's too hard to sit there and watch it in person?
Well, it's just one of those things. It's like a superstition almost. You don't go to the Super Bowl until you've played in it.
How do you watch the Super Bowl? Depends. Depends on how much you care about the teams. Depends who you're watching with. Depends on your level of interest and knowledge. We've already covered the average football fan and the total newbie. But what should someone who really knows the game watch for?
I look at formation. Are they doing a lot of 2 tight end sets? Are they completely open sets? And what are they? Are they under center quite a bit? I still believe, and they've gone away from this, but I still believe the more you're under center, the more deception you have in your offense. You're able to play action pass more. You're able to do different running plays. I think out of shotgun, you are limited to me in some of the things that you can do. And so I look at that. I'm looking at the defense, obviously. Are they moving around? Are they stagnant? Are they blitzing a lot? And then once the ball is snapped, I'm watching the front 7, meaning the offensive linemen plus the down linemen and linebackers, and how are they, who's winning there, who's not winning.
That was Eric Winston, longtime offensive lineman and current president of the NFL Players Association. And here is advice from John Urschel, the Ravens offensive lineman, who's also getting his PhD in applied math.
I would tell them, pick any position that they find interesting, whether it's cornerback or whether it's a certain wide receiver, and you'll really notice more about the game if you just pick a position or even pick a player and just watch that player the entire game, just to see what that person's game is like the whole game. Because very often, you know, football fans, even hardcore football fans who know a lot, they're always watching the action and they kind of miss out on the idea of, well, what's this player's day actually like? So if you look at a wide receiver, what is that wide receiver doing on pass plays where the main route combination is not to his side? What is he doing when it's a run play? Is he running them off? Is he just jogging? Is he talking to the cornerback? What is going on there?
Offensive linemen are in the unfortunate position of when, on the rare occasion that they make a mistake and are called for holding or motion or something, that is often one of the only times that their name is mentioned on the broadcast and the camera goes to them and so on. It's just an unfortunate situation.
Well, no offensive lineman will ever admit this, but since we're talking, you know, mathematically, holding happens a lot during a game, but only gets called. And when it gets called, it's always kind of a little questionable. Should it have been called? Shouldn't it have been called? So there's this always this risk-reward as an offensive lineman for how long you hold for, how hard you hold in terms of how often you get holding calls during the season as opposed to how much this helps you maintain your block.
Do you find that an offensive lineman or a defensive lineman is more prone to fatigue?
Defensive linemen, certainly, because they have to run to the football. So an offensive lineman's job is I'm blocking this man and I'm stopping him from either getting to the quarterback or getting to the running back. And while his job is to get to the quarterback or the running back, so, you know, I'm blocking him and suppose the running back runs all the way to the other side, eventually he's going to get off my block. He's never going to get to the guy, but he still has to start running in that direction. If the quarterback throws the ball and a receiver catches it, well, I'm not much good downfield. I'm running downfield, but the defensive lineman has to sprint downfield to try to help to make the tackle. So they get tired much more quickly than we do. Also, I think there's some fatigue involved in not knowing what's happening. So they have to always be going, always be, you know, aggressive. Whereas I know the play, I know what's going to happen. They have to figure this out.
That's such an interesting point because there's a lot of social science research, psychology particularly, that shows that uncertainty is exhausting and people make really poor decisions under uncertainty. So you're saying that even for the defensive, or for anyone on the defense, I guess, you've got that doubt all game long.
Yes, you've got this constant uncertainty.
If you ever want to watch smart football players, especially on the defensive side, just pick a defensive end.
And that again is Justin Tuck, an all-pro defensive end who spent 9 seasons with the New York Football Giants, including their 2 Super Bowl wins over the New England Patriots.
And most of the time, the defensive ends that are really, really late getting in their stance, they've X'd out plays that they know are not coming. I used to do it. I learned it from Strahan and OC when I was playing with those guys.
He's talking about Michael Strahan and OC Umanyora.
But I would always get in my stance last second because I wanted to see what the offense was doing. I wanted to see, do they have trips into the boundary? Is the running back 8 yards deep or versus 6 or 7 yards deep? Quarterback on the shotgun. What is the hand of the offensive lineman that I'm going against? What is that telling me? How is his foot positioned? Is he blocking down? Is he blocking towards me? Is his weight back because he wants to kick out because of the pass? Things like that is what experts look at. You know, are they going in motion to see if we're playing man? Is this a situation where we might get hard counting? Is it third and short? Should I watch the ball more intently than I would if it was third and long? But the better you get at it, the quicker it goes. So, you know, you normally have, once they come to the line of scrimmage, you probably have 5 seconds at the max, depending on the type of offense you're playing against. And you have to kind of, you know, decipher all this information like that and be able to go and play. And I think the teams that do that the best are the teams that, you know, play really, really well.
When you say you want to go into your stance late, is it because you want to be upright to see better longer or you want to adjust your stance?
Both.
Okay.
Both.
So you're going to, okay. So the more information you have, the more you know what stance you want.
Exactly. And you know, I always told people, for example, we used to have defenses, it was kind of like a check with me defense where we would change defenses as the offense changed or so on and so forth. So as a D lineman, I had to listen to guys behind me. And I would tell my linebackers, don't tell me anything once my hand's in the ground, because once my hand's in the ground, my mind has went completely black, and it's more figuring out or focusing on how I beat this guy right in front of me. You know, when I put my hand in the ground, it could be 80,000 people in the stands. I don't hear any of them. So that's one of the reasons why I stood up longer, because, you know, we would be checking defenses and going from blitzes to, you know, cover twos or whatever it may be. And you have to hear that stuff and then adjust to it. And so me standing up or me not putting my hand in the dirt as long as possible gave me a better chance of being able to adjust.
How valuable would you say, and I would ask you to kind of put on your NBA hat here, because now you're thinking about risk-reward and all that. How valuable in, let's say, in one given football game is the element of surprise? So, you know, it's like a game theory question. Theoretically, yeah. If the offense can surprise you every time, or at least randomize, and I'm ahead of the game. On the other hand, by insisting on wanting to surprise you, I might do things that are not playing to my strength. So I'm curious, as a defensive player, what you thought of, not necessarily trick plays, but, you know, how much the offense tried to fool you.
You know, I think it's a fine line between trying to fool players, because you got to think, as a defensive player, most of my time isn't spent on the actual field running around trying to stop offenses. Most of my time is spent watching film, trying to figure out, you know, what their tendencies are. So coming to a football game, I have a pretty good sense of what they like to do in certain situations, which allows me to play really, really fast.
But on the other hand, they know that you know that. So
yeah.
That's where the game theory happens, right? So they
sure.
know that you, Justin Tuck, have watched 12 hours of what, you know, X team is going to do on third and long. And so they know that you know that, then they might want to, you know, outsmart you.
Yeah, they might, but they also are doing something now that they're probably not as good at as well. So I think it's pretty much, you know, a similar outcome. You might get me once on that trick play, but the next time you try it, you might lose a 15 yards and set your offense back. But I also say this, I'm more from the old school where I believe that regardless, if they know what I'm doing or not, if I execute what I'm doing better than him, then I'm going to win. So I've always been in the mindset, I don't care if they know what I'm doing. As long as I'm doing it at 100% of my capacity, then I'm fine with that.
In terms of outfoxing the other team, or at least trying to optimize your play calling, Steve Levitt and a colleague wrote a paper on this very topic. It's called Professionals Do Not Play Minimax, and it analyzed about 125,000 NFL play choices.
We found at the time, which was about 5 or 6, 7 years ago, we found that teams systematically ran the ball too much. That given the outcomes of plays, it looked like if teams were to pass a lot more than they did, things would actually get better. And I can't say that it is actually causal. I doubt that the NFL football teams read our paper and dramatically changed the way they did things. But I am happy to report that in the years since we wrote that paper, there was a dramatic increase in the share of plays from scrimmage that became passes versus runs when that trend hadn't been there at all prior to our writing. So maybe I should take credit for it, even though it's almost certainly impossible that I have made NFL football more efficient.
Steve Levitt has one more piece of advice for anyone watching the Super Bowl, regardless of interest level.
The beauty of the Super Bowl is that you can virtually gamble on any aspect of it. So not just the final score, who will win, but even who will win the opening coin toss. And I remember one year you could actually bet on whether Jay-Z would also appear along with Beyonce in the halftime show. And so if you want to have some fun, you can go to a sports book. You can look at, you know, the literally hundreds of different betting options that are there. And without even the trouble of going and making an account at the sportsbook, I would suggest you find a friend and you divvy up the bets and you bet on, you know, 50 or 75 things and you keep track of who wins what. And it can keep you busy for the entire game. And if it's the sort of thing where you don't get any pleasure out of taking money from your friends, then I would suggest that you find one of your enemies and you actually divvy up all the bets with one of your enemies so that if you actually happen to win a lot, you can take great joy in that outcome.
Coming up on Freakonomics Radio, to what degree is our society self-organizing, self-policing? Is there really someone in charge of this whole thing? We'll start where else? In a skating rink. And we'll take to the field with some ultimate frisbee players to see what happens when you play a sport with no referees.
Foul! Foul called!
That's next on Freakonomics Radio.
From WNYC Studios, this is Freakonomics Radio. With your host, Stephen Dubner.
Hi, I'm Dan Klein. I'm a professor of economics at George Mason University. I got into economics very much from a policy, or if you like, political point of view.
Now, Dan, the reason that we are talking today really is because of an essay you wrote called Rinkonomics that I would like you, since we're not going to sit here and read it to listeners, I'd like you to describe.
Okay. If you try to imagine never having seen skating, never having been to a roller rink, maybe back in time before it was invented, and you heard someone propose the idea, like a friend came up and proposed, I have a great idea for a business. I'm going to build this huge arena with a hard wooden floor and around the perimeter a naked iron handrail. and invite people of all ages and all abilities to come down and strap wheels on their feet and skate around and try to, you know, enjoy themselves. We're not going to, like, make sure they qualify in their abilities. We're not going to put helmets on them or shoulder pads. And we're not going to give them really any instruction.
Now, you might think that'd be pure chaos, wouldn't you? Sure. That's what you might think.
You'd expect it to result in catastrophe and collision. How are 100 people making their moment-by-moment decisions going to sort of make their own pattern of skating such that, you know, all 100 patterns do not collide and intersect? It's a very complex problem, but as it turns out, it goes quite, you know, swimmingly, as we know. And so if you had to sort of pitch this idea to someone investing in it, you'd have to explain how you think this is going to work. And it's in that explanation that I think we can enhance our understanding of how things work in society generally. I think the main thing to understand is that people are, you know, looking out for themselves. I'm not saying they're selfish, but they're basically looking out for themselves. And most importantly, they don't want to get hurt by colliding with anybody. Now, one of the important things about collision is that it's very mutual. So, you know, if I collide with you, you collide with me. And in promoting my interest to avoid collision with you, I simultaneously promote your interest in avoiding collision with me. So there's this basic coincidence of interest there, which really is at the microstructure of how this whole thing works out.
When he talks about how this whole thing works out, Dan Klein is talking about the skating rink on a micro level. But on a macro level, he's talking about, well, the world. He's talking about an idea known in economics as spontaneous order. That is, the idea that people can be quite good at organizing and policing themselves, even when there's no one imposing order from above. Now, isn't that a wonderful idea? If, that is, it actually works. So, in today's program, we'll ask, does it work? If so, when and how? And with what caveats?
Get there!
Today's show begins outdoors, on a beautiful athletic field, with my friend Jody Avergan.
All right, so Jody, good morning. Where are we?
We are on Randall's Island, which is off of Manhattan, but it's a big practice facility, lots of fields out here, and it is where the club team, the New York men's club team, which goes by the name of PONY, which stands for Pride of New York, it's where the team practices every weekend.
The sport he's talking about is Ultimate Frisbee, or as real Ultimate Frisbee people call it, simply Ultimate. Avergan has a day job producing and hosting podcasts for 538, but he is an ultimate lifer.
And I can just tell you that I take it way too seriously.
He played in college, then on high-level club teams like PONY, which he captained for a few years, and he ultimately played pro ultimate for the New York Rumble. Avergan has also coached the U.S. under-19 national ultimate team to a gold medal at the World Championships, twice. If you've never seen Ultimate played and you think it's just a bunch of stoners throwing around a frisbee, if you think it's not a sport, you are wrong. It's sort of a mix of soccer and basketball played with a disc. There are 7 players per side on a field roughly the size of a soccer field. You score a goal by passing the disc across the far goal line. You can't run with the disc, so as soon as someone passes it to you, you're immediately looking for a teammate who will be sprinting downfield for a long pass or maybe coming back for a short one. He's got a defender on him, and you've got one on you trying to block your throw. The play is continuous, which means that if the disc hits the ground or if it gets intercepted, the defensive team immediately goes on offense and vice versa. One more thing. Ultimate is, technically at least, a non-contact sport.
You decide who gets the disc first by flipping a, want to take a wild guess?
A disc
you
itself?
You flip a disc.
There you go,
itself.
Head to tail.
Yeah,
okay,
come on,
good.
A disc has
makes
two
sense.
Sides, just like a coin,
great.
It's like a giant coin.
Okay, and then is there a referee who stands at midfield and blows a whistle and says, gentlemen, throw your disc?
You ask that question so innocently. Is there a referee standing there? And of course, that is the reason why I'm here, Stephen, because for so long, ultimate generally has been a sport that's played without refs. Uh-huh. That's the reason I'm here, right?
That is the reason you're here. This is all idle chit-chat getting up to right. this fascinating point. Okay.
And actually, can I hand you one little thing that I want you to read,
sure.
which is this is I'm handing you the preface to the official rules of Self-Policed Ultimate. So this is you open the rule book. This is page one. Read that first paragraph.
From the preface to the official rules of Ultimate, it is assumed that no player will intentionally violate the rules. Thus, there are no harsh penalties for inadvertent infractions, but rather a method for resuming play in a manner that simulates what most likely would have occurred absent the infraction, what we used to call the do-over, right?
Yeah.
In Ultimate, an intentional infraction is considered cheating and a gross offense against the spirit of sportsmanship. Often, a player is in a position to gain an advantage by committing an infraction, but that player is morally bound to abide by the rules. The integrity of Ultimate depends on each player's responsibility to uphold the spirit of the game.
Yep.
And this responsibility should remain paramount.
So, you know, there it is, baked into the first thing you read when you open after the table of contents, when you open the rules.
So, one, two, three, big swing, yes.
So, let's say there's a disc in the air and two players are chasing it down. We'll call them Friedrich and John Maynard, or JM.
Big hit, baby.
JM is on offense. They both jump for the disc.
Up.
There's some contact, and neither one catches it. Now, if JM thinks that the contact from Friedrich prevented him from making the catch, he'll yell out,
foul!
There's no ref, no whistle, just JM.
And there are very clear rules of the game. Ultimate isn't structured so that we make the rules up as we go. Ultimate is structured just that we adjudicate the rules on our own.
Now, Friedrich, accused of the foul, he has two choices. He can say contest, which means that he contests the foul call, or no contest, which means he agrees that he committed a foul. If he doesn't contest, then JM's team keeps possession at the spot of the foul. But if Friedrich does contest, well, here's what happens. JM's team still keeps possession, although the disc goes back to where the throw came from. In other words, it's a do-over. Or, as someone less charitable might put it, it's a giant loophole.
Yes, and that, I think, is, you know, the crux of the rules as they are structured and self-policed in Ultimate, is that ultimately it's... I use ultimately. is that in the end, it sort of favors the person making the call. In theory, I can always retain possession of the disc.
Exactly.
Right? I could exploit that. There is a loophole there that you could drive a national championship through if you wanted to.
So if there's no referee, what stops an Ultimate player from driving through that loophole again and again? Well, believe it or not, it's morality. Here, again, from the official rule book, a player is, quote, morally bound to abide by the rules.
One of the big lessons of Ultimate for me is a lesson in empathy, which is that most people, most times, if not almost all the time, think they are acting fairly. So when someone makes a call, I really have to remind myself that they genuinely think, right, that they were fouled, or they genuinely think that they got their hand under that disc before it came up. I have to remember that I don't know if I've ever encountered someone who's just straight up cheating. Mm-hmm. I honestly don't know.
So that sounds awesome in theory, in that you're right. I mean, the idea of a civil society is if you give people enough latitude to behave in a certain way themselves and to kind of adjudicate the actions of others rather than, you know, these kind of bright lines of rules. And the idea is that everybody kind of integrates the rules into their behavior from the outset. My question is, however, this isn't just walking down the street or even driving and giving someone else the right of way. This is inherently a game, which is a competition. So how does it work? In other words, I can imagine that everybody is kind of, very civic-minded for the first three quarters of the competition. And then the score is 13-12. Mm-hmm. And all of a sudden, I can imagine things get very hairy and there's nobody to referee. So what begins to happen as the stakes get higher?
I think you just pinpointed it exactly. As the stakes get higher, the more pressure is put on this system. But, you know, the theory is that as Ultimate players, we have sort of entered this game knowing what's at stake. We we've chosen this sport because it is structured differently. It has this element, spirit of the game, that isn't just sort of, you know, an inconvenient truth or whatever. It is part of the actual DNA of the game. But I mean, part of me, you know, I'll be perfectly honest. As someone who loves Ultimate, you know, I read this stuff, it's a little highfalutin, right? I mean, to open the rule book and get a little sort of, you know, a lecture in moral responsibility might be a little much. And I know there's Ultimate players who say, you know, this Ultimate exceptionalism needs to end. You know, this idea that we're the only ones who can sort of behave in a morally responsible manner is absurd. People do that all the time within refereed sports.
But so what would you think would happen if you could take soccer, the way it's played now, all over the world at incredibly high levels with huge stakes, and say, you know what, for a year, let's play this game everywhere with no referees, have it be self-policed like the game of Ultimate. What would happen?
You know, I tend to believe in this idea of the culture of the sport. So it would be a very rocky transition. Ultimate has this culture that's been ingrained in it for a long time that I think has led people to behave a certain way. That said, I also believe that people tend to have the capacity to act as fair brokers, and over time you probably could pull it off. But soccer would very quickly, if not immediately, start having the same difficult conversations that Ultimate is having right now.
And, in other words, some people want to bring referees into Ultimate.
We're starting to see changes. And what's happening right now is I think there's this really interesting sort of laboratory moment in Ultimate where we kind of almost have three different kinds of Ultimate happening at the same time, being played in parallel. Those three.
Okay, so what do we have? We have the pure self-policing.
Right, which is the way it's been played for years and years and years. And then we have, on the other end of the spectrum, we have fully refereed, which is this pro league that I'm playing in is fully refereed. And then you have this sort of hybrid model in between, which is called the observer model.
Okay, and what does the observer do and have the power to do? It's not quite a referee, it sounds like. Yeah.
Right, exactly. So the simplest way to think of the observer is they are there to resolve disputes, but they don't make active calls.
Okay, back to the scenario with Friedrich and JM. They both jump for the disc, and JM calls
foul.
Now, even with an observer on the field, they can still resolve the call themselves. Friedrich can admit he committed the foul.
Oh, wow. That's my fault. Sorry.
Or JM can retract the call. But if they can't agree, instead of the do-over in this case, they will send the call to the observer, who now has the power to make a decision.
Is it in?
This is in. Go ahead.
And if he really thinks that Friedrich didn't foul JM, he can award the disc to Friedrich's team.
To me, you know, this is my preferred, I'm showing my hand here, this is my preferred system because it does provide this sort of safety valve moment where you can go to a third party and they can rule. And then what happens is you don't have to be mad at your opponent. You can be mad at the observer, which is a real advantage of a sort of third party in a way.
Right.
Like, I don't have to feel betrayed by you, right? Which, on the one hand, Ultimate is really satisfying when the two of us step up to the plate and act in a moral manner. But it's also really terrible when I feel like you're not being a fair broker.
Gotcha. But let me just for a minute play Pollyanna or maybe Angel's Advocate and say, wouldn't it be amazing if you could play this sport at the very highest level and it were totally self-policed and in doing so signal to the world that humans are perfectly capable of policing themselves, of ordering themselves, of being fair to themselves and others, even in a highly competitive environment. And therefore, by doing so, you could kind of set an example for how others in non-sports environments, whether it's a marketplace, whether it's in politics, whether it's in, you know, neighborhood relations, tribal relations, could do the same. Wouldn't that be kind of great?
I think I generally agree with you that the real world has more to learn from Ultimate than Ultimate does from the real world. Now, you know, how do you inject that in a systematic fashion into other areas? I'm realistic enough to know that, you know, when we've asked politicians and Wall Street to self-regulate, chances are they won't. So I think it's really more about sort of the individual lessons of sports. You know, I love sports. I think sports teach you a lot, but I don't think sports are this sort of microcosm of the real world. I think sports are sports. And the stuff that you learn there is often about how you behave in the real world as opposed to the sort of systems that we can implement elsewhere. I think that that's what makes it unique in the marketplace, and I think is what makes, you know, ultimate players good people, and they learn good lessons from this sport.
Coming up on Freakonomics Radio, maybe we're thinking too small. Maybe we should be talking about humanity without referees.
I really do genuinely believe that the appearance of social order and of technology and social complexity is an evolutionary phenomenon, quite literally a Darwinian phenomenon, a competition between ideas and a sort of collaborative enterprise.
From WNYC Studios, this is Freakonomics Radio. Here's your host, Stephen Dubner.
On today's show, we're talking about spontaneous order. That's the idea that people can, under some circumstances at least, do a really good job of policing and regulating themselves. You have heard, of course, of the invisible hand. That's the phrase that the economist Adam Smith used more than 250 years ago to describe how people and markets organize and regulate themselves. The phrase spontaneous order was popularized many years later by Friedrich Hayek, who updated Adam Smith for the 20th century. To those who believe in the freest of free markets, Friedrich Hayek is almost a god. So, Levitt, are you a Friedrich Hayek guy? Is he one of the economists whose pictures you had up on your wall when you were a kid?
No, I've always kind of wondered what he was all about, to be honest.
That's my Freakonomics friend and co-author Steve Levitt. He's an economist at the University of Chicago. So what do you think when you think of him?
Well, you know, these guys always talk, these intellectuals are always talking about him and libertarian and stuff like that. But, you know, I'm kind of ignorant. I don't think I've ever really read much of what he wrote, even though he hung out at Chicago for a while.
For a little while, yeah. For a while.
Yeah.
So one notion he's known for having developed kind of as an economist come philosopher is this notion of spontaneous order, which is basically that people and even firms and institutions are better at working things out on their own than if some central planner makes a lot of rules and tells everybody how everything must be done. You must have some thoughts on that notion, yes?
Yeah, I think that to me sounds like economics. I think it's hard to find an economist who thinks that you do better by having a central planner decide what activities people should be engaged in, then letting the market sort it out. Although, you know, my own opinion maybe is a little bit tempered because I think that so much of what happens in markets depends upon the existence of property rights and a well-functioning society and the background of a government and a criminal justice system and all that. So I think, to me, when I think about economics, I think that there's a very fundamental role that government plays, which is to make sure that people are protected. And then after that, probably the less government does, the better, except maybe figure out how to redistribute money to poor people if we want to do some of that.
There are some obvious upsides to that, but then there's the argument that individuals and corporations will sometimes exploit that freedom to the detriment of society. Without government regulation and oversight, we'd have anarchy, right? So that's the question. Where should spontaneous order end and regulation begin?
Well, if I had a simple answer to that question, we wouldn't have argued about it for 250 years, I would guess.
That's Matt Ridley. He's a scientist and author who leans libertarian, but instead of beating up on government, he joined it.
Just recently, I had a rush of blood to the head and got myself elected to the UK House of Lords, which is possible only if you inherit a hereditary title, as it happens that I did.
So in your book, The Rational Optimist, you argue that human beings, I'll quote you here a little bit, are not only wealthier, but happier, cleaner, cleverer, kinder, freer, more peaceful, and more equal than they've ever been. Much of this progress you attribute to, and again, I'll quote you briefly, collective intelligence evolving by trial and error, resulting from the sharing of ideas through exchange and specialization. Now, if you've anyone who's read even a little bit of political economy knows that the sharing of ideas has to do I wouldn't say it's code for, but it's language that gets us into the realm of governments and regulation and the role of governments. Now, to my mind at least, such an environment where ideas and innovation and trade flow freely will not arise necessarily in the presence of intense regulation or policing. That is the theme of our episode of Radio here today. Is that a theme or at least a sub-theme of your book as well?
Very much so. I use the word how prosperity evolves. And I really do genuinely believe that the appearance of social order and of technology and social complexity is an evolutionary phenomenon, quite literally a Darwinian phenomenon, a competition between ideas and, as I say, a sort of collaborative enterprise. Because, I mean, of course, you know, really I'm only repeating what Adam Smith said 250 years ago, and he got an awful lot right. And he was a big influence on Darwin. And Darwin, for me, is essentially Adam Smith in nature, or vice versa, if you like. I gave a lecture recently called Adam Darwin about how they're basically saying the same thing, i.e. that there is spontaneous order. It turns out that if you want to make biological evolution work, you have to exchange genes. You have to have the swapping and the miscegenation of genes to throw up new combinations of genes so as to experiment and to select the ones that are good and not the ones that are bad. And very much the same thing is happening in human affairs, where you have people exchanging goods, exchanging services, and exchanging ideas, then you get extraordinary progress in human conditions.
Now, I think that even the most interventionalist wouldn't argue with what you just said. It sounds, we kind of accept that as a truism almost of progress and of a functioning commercial society, but then we start to have the conversation about, well, yes, but unfettered markets, unfettered trade is not a good thing because there will always be those who seek to take advantage of another, who gain a certain amount of leverage and so on. So talk to me for a moment about how you see that barrier between free trade, innovation and so on, progress, and the proper amount of regulation as exercised by a government or some other institution?
It's a very good question, and it's a very difficult one. My starting point is that on the whole, societies that have had too much freedom and therefore have got into trouble are really very few and far between. You could argue that the anarchy in Somalia is an example, but you know, there are so many more North Koreas than there are Somalias in history, if you like, that on the whole, what causes predation by one human being on another, what causes people to steal from each other rather than to trade with each other and find mutual gain, tends to be too much government rather than too little. We've got endless examples of this, from Napoleon to the Ming emperors to tyrants today like the North Korean ruling family. So chiefs, priests and thieves, as I put it, have actually been a continuing problem in the world. Now, that doesn't mean that you can survive with no government.
Can you give me an example of what you feel is just the kind of perfect or near-perfect self-regulating environment? Maybe it's an institution, large or small, maybe it's an industry or a group of people. I'm just curious to know, what would be an environment where you see it working just right?
Well, of course, nothing's perfect, is it? But to come to human societies, there are some rather lovely sort of examples of which Eleanor Ostrom used to write about this problem of the tragedy of the commons, and how actually there are some quite neat solutions to it that have worked very well over many, many centuries or decades. I mean, as a general rule, the sort of market among traders, etc. I mean, I was walking along a street in London the other day, and there were, you know, it was a Sunday market. There were lots of markets out. And I was just thinking, you know, this is amazing. All these people are trying to give
things to other people. Give trinkets or pictures or food or fruit or whatever it is to other people. And isn't it kind of them? And all the other people are wanting to give them bits of money. And isn't that nice of them? Because one lot wants money and the other lot wants trinkets, and both are getting what they want. And nobody's getting upset, or not that I could tell. I haven't seen a policeman anywhere on the street, etc. You know, we overlook this. And sure, there's, in the end, there's a policeman somewhere. And in the end, you know, there are frightful rows between stallholders in a market or between them and their customers. But, you know, 99% of the time, that kind of simple system works really nicely.
On the other hand, there is the argument made by some economists that we also overlook the fact that the reason it does work so smoothly and well is because we do have this huge and long-standing infrastructure. As one economist put it to me one day, every contract ever agreed upon, whether verbally or in print, is backed up by the 101st Airborne. That the rule of law is made strong, and the rule of the economy is made strong by the rule of, you know, in this case, government or military even. And I guess what I'm looking for is to give whoever's listening to this program a better way to think about the proper amount of order and regulation from above and the proper amount from within. And I just wonder if you might have any added thought on that.
So getting the right balance is clearly key. You can tell from what I'm saying that I think on the whole, the balance is more likely to be in favor of too much top-downery and not enough bottom-uppery in most cases. But of course, that doesn't mean that I, you know, quite often that position is then caricatured as meaning, therefore, you want no government at all.
Right.
And I say, Lordy, no, that would be really quite worrying. And you're quite right, the 101st Airborne is there if we need them. And at the end of the day, you know, the fact that I would eventually go to jail is one of the things that stops me deciding to kill and murder my way to wealth and power.
So, one, two, three, four. Good boy, Jesse!
All right. One last scenario I want to run by you. You grew up in England, yes?
Yes.
You grew up playing football then, or rugby, or both?
A little bit of both, but very, very badly in my own case.
Now, have you ever played Ultimate Frisbee, the sport called Ultimate Frisbee?
Oh, yeah. Funnily enough, last weekend I was introduced to that concept by American friends the first time. I don't think I'd heard the phrase before. I may have done, but it hadn't clicked with me.
So here's what I want to ask you. So this sport has evolved quite nicely over the last few decades to the point where there are club teams and even now professional teams, and it's competed on a national and even international level. And in most cases, up until the very highest tiers of the sport, it is entirely self-police. There are no referees. So if there's a dispute on the field, a foul or any kind of infraction, the players resolve their own disputes with no central authority policing the field. Now, I'm curious, having grown up among the culture of fully refereed sports, you're the country that invented soccer, football, as you call it, and tennis and cricket and all these sports, and there's always, it's very important to have a referee or a sport policeman present. I'm just curious how you would see, let's say, the English national soccer team playing against, let's say, the German team or the Italian or the Brazilian with no referee, no officials on the field. What would that scenario look like? Could it be successful? If so, what would it take to be successful?
Well, I think after some teething troubles, it might work. The teething troubles obviously would be that, you know, there would be somebody would hack someone down and then someone else would take revenge on them and there'd be a brawl, because that's the way they behave at the moment until the referee stops them brawling. But given that you know that if you hack someone down, you're going to be hacked down yourself into this new system, you know, given that you know that with a refereed system, you can kind of get away with it. And without a referee system, you won't get away with it because the other team will take it out on you. I think it would quickly evolve to be quite peaceful.
Thank you.
I'm Stephen Dubner, and that was Freakonomics Radio. Thanks for listening. We will be back next week. If you just can't wait that long, you can get our entire Freakonomics Radio podcast archive at Freakonomics.com or at iTunes, where you can also subscribe.